Hey everyone, my name is Reeves and welcome back to another edition of Living with Jim Crow. Today I'm going to continue with my series interviewing my uncle, the Reverend Ray Owens Sr., as he gives me some more in-depth and detailed discussion of his experiences growing up in the Deep South during the 1950s and the 60s. Now, he's going to share with me his experiences participating or being exposed to integration for the very first time in my rural hometown of Pine Bluff, Arkansas.
Who in a place called we had our own black swimming pool, Townsend Park. That's it. And Townsend Park was a wonderful pool. Me and Lewis Jr. would go down and swim all the time during the summer, during the weekends, because we work during the weekdays, picking cotton, chopping cotton, something like that. And we never knew, though, that just down the street about, you know, a mile and a half was the white park. Okay, and so when we finally found out, we got ran away from the white park. We got ran away from there. And we went back to our park, Townsend Park, where we swam in our beautiful swimming pool, and we did whatever we did. But then came integration, brother man. And integration brought daring do and excitement. And so we had, we decided we was going to go, the guys from the college decided they was going to integrate the white pool. Well, we had never been to the white pool because it was so, what can I say? It was guarded, you know what I mean? You just couldn't go there and go swim, you know, you were black. And we saw this beautiful Olympic-sized swimming pool with stands to watch on both sides, that big old pool, huge diving board that was 3 feet and 10 feet, and I think it was 20 feet. But, boy, it was a beautiful park. So we decided to integrate it. I ain't going to say we. The college boys decided to integrate it. We heard about it. I was in high school then. Okay, I think it was my last year in high school. And so we got in Jeremiah's car, and we all rolled down it because we had understood that this they were going to integrate. And so lo and behold, we go out, and we go to the pool, white pool, and here comes our black folk, man. Was one of the lifeguards, and they come in with some girls, you know what I mean, and they get into the 3 foot water. I said, what in the world? And they splashing around, splashing each other and everything. I said, what kind of stuff is this? If you guys can swim, fish look silly, but in the 3 feet, and lo and behold, I understood why. I think I'm the white boys, big strapping, mountain cornbread eating white boys. And they get in the pool and they, you know, sashay over to the where the girls are, and they start dunking the girls and they start dunking the boys. And that's when the fight started, in the water. And I understood. Duman and his boys did a number on them. Actually, did a number on each other. I can't say who won. But they called the cops. The cops couldn't do anything because they were in the pool, you know. So they just stood there and watched. And when they watched, that's when more white boys came on in, okay. And they came on until they overwhelmed. Well, that's when the girl started screaming. Everybody started screaming. And more cops came and finally got them out of there. That was interaction that wasn't warranted. We didn't want it. Other than that, other than the Boy Scouts, other than working for them, there was really no interaction. Even the Christmas parade. I don't know if you remember the Christmas parade.
Yes, so I do.
They were all black, okay, in my time. And even in your time, you know, we would have Grambling sometimes at Arkansas A&M, we'd have Southern. We'd have, you know, the high schools, Maryland, Southeast, and others. And it was a black parade. I remember taking my son to it. And he was like flabbergasted. He didn't know any better. You know. But yeah, that was the interaction that we had. We didn't know interaction in school. That was no school interaction.
I'm just listening to the difference here because on one hand, you got, of course, I'm assuming all the boys were different, but you're telling me the story about how you guys played football with them, and it didn't sound like, you know, other than, you know, the normal roughhousing that you would expect from football. No problems there, but then the integration of pool, fight breaks out.
Yeah, you were. See, now don't let me picture of the football play. It wasn't organized. Okay. It was what we call hot ball then, you know. And lo and behold, you if you got the ball, you run with it, you know, and you up against black and white trying to tackle you, you know what I mean, that type of thing. But pool is a different story. You're coming into their neighborhood on their turf, and they're saying, hell no, you got to go, you know what I mean? So that was a difference. That was very, very little, really, not communication, but there was very little coming together and sharing and loving each other, or even just going. There was no going to school now. There was no going to school together, because all the schools were black and all white.
Now, you mentioned the pools as well as the different schools. Can you mention some other places that you went to that catered to both black and white, and just tell me what differences that was readily apparent?
Well, there was the cotton fields. And of course, that's pretty much obvious. The cotton fields belonged to them, but it was white, what they call poor whites and poor blacks. We were just trying to make our $4 a day or $3.50 a day chopping cotton in the summertime. That'd make no difference. I mean, there was, they wouldn't let us come together. If you could envision a huge field, like 4 football fields long and wide, on one end would be the black kids and on the other end would be the white, and you work toward each other. Okay? You may call each other names and so forth, but you work toward each other, and they would not let us come together. They would take the whites and send them another field, or us and send us in another field before we got together. So it wasn't that type of, you know, interaction. I think the only other interaction was when you went swimming in the swimming hole, Lake Pine Bluff somewhere. You know, and that's only by accident. It's not a, you know, opportunity to come together and socialize and, you know, have tea or drink or whatever. But it was just the way it was, pure white. Just pure segregation.
For those of you who are students of history, you probably readily remember that there was a large number of civil rights organizations that were prominently in active life during those time periods trying to take action with regards to change. One of those organizations was the Student Nonviolent Coordinative Committee, or SNCC, as it is affectionately referred to, which was comprised primarily of college students who were participating in all types of events such as sit-ins, marches, and voters registration. Take a listen as my Uncle Ray shares his initial exposure to civil rights organizations, particularly SNCC in our hometown of Pine Bluff, and the family connection that we had with that organization.
When did you graduate from high school? Were there any civil rights activities or going on in Pine Bluff around that time?
Oh, yeah. That was Nick and my brother Jay Jr. Your uncle Jay Jr. was part of the SNCC group, and they would they went to Woolworths to – I wanted to go there. And me and Lewis Jr., we we were like brothers, and we did everything and together. And if Mom and Dad said we couldn't go, we say, yes, Mom and Dad, and go anyway. And see, everybody in the neighborhood knew you, so it wasn't like nobody knew where you were. All you had to do is ask one person, Miss Leo, where's Ray Owen? He went with Lewis Jr. over to the park. Everybody knew it because everybody knew who everybody was. But what was that question again?
Civil rights activity. You were mentioning that Uncle Ray was a member of Uncle Jay Jr. was a member of a Student Nonviolent Coordinator Committee, which I didn't know.
Yeah, he was, and he did go to Woolworth to go into the to segregate the county. What was SNCC? SNCC was, I don't know if you know where Marion Humphrey lived. Well, that's why he's a judge too, isn't he?
He is, and I know the name. I just don't know exactly where he lives.
Okay, well, he used to live. It's gone now. But it was a place over there, and next to, not too far from him, that the SNCC used to meet. And so they decided they was going to go to Woolworth and to integrate the county counter, and they did. And so I went with them in Lewis Jr. I think we stood across the street, you know. And, yeah, they were spitting on Jay Jr. and hitting him and the others as well, but they went on in there. They didn't serve him. You know, they may call the cops. The cops got him out. And actually, the cops treated him pretty good. They didn't beat him or nothing. It was only the people that was, you know, hitting on him and spitting on him. Yeah. That was, I don't know, 63 or something like that. But that was about it for civil rights. That and that what they did at Arkansas Eminem College. You know, they tried not to let us know it and get involved, but guess what? You can't hide nothing from the hood. We found out everything they did. You know, our challenge was to get there, you know. Find a way to get there. But
what happened at Arkansas M&M?
Oh, these are where the students, you know, were boisterous and made protests and so forth. You know, they made their voices heard at Arkansas M&M College. They weren't supposed to, but they did anyway. Now I don't know exactly what they does. I left in 64. So, you know, and I never did get really interested in it. I was only interested in my brother when he went to, and him and George Davis, Sterling Rolfe became a dentist and a big fellow over there in Arkansas, in Pine Bluff, rather. And I'm sure Glenda will tell you about it, Sterling Rolfe and George Davis. Fellas, they were the smart fellas. They were the geniuses like yourself. Okay, me and Lewis Jr. were less, I ain't going to say less intelligent, but less intelligent acting. Yeah.
Now, I do, my mom always told me that, she said that, I guess Sterling and Uncle Jay graduated together and they were really good friends.
Yeah,
I didn't know that they were members. I didn't know they were active in SNCC, though.
Well, not too people knew, and not too many people liked SNCC, too, because, you know, people lost jobs, and people, you know, were, you know, when they took active part in SNCC. So it wasn't a welcome thing. And don't forget, we were kids, man.
Now, did grandma and granddad know that Uncle Jay was participating in SNCC?
Now, if they did, they didn't say nothing about it because Jay Jr. was first born and that meant something at that time. And what it meant was, you know, you're going to lead the way in the family. And so he did, academically anyway. And he did. And he always was an outstanding young man. He did stuff like form a band and bring the band to church. And they performed his little quartet that he started, you know. They performed at our church functions and everything. And, of course, now we were very close-knit with University of Arkansas Pine Bluff, or Arkansas Eminent College. You got to ask Linda about that, because Mama and Daddy went there for a couple of years before he had to do what he had to do. And when I came back from the war, I tried to get in there. They said, you can't. No, they let me in, praise the Lord, for a couple of classes. But they led the way when it came to, they should have a history about their involvement in the civil rights movement, stuff like that.
One of the devastating tragedies of U.S. history is the assassination of Martin Luther King. With his tragic death, there were mass amounts of various displays of outrage and grief that were displayed in a variety of different communities across the country. Every area of the country was touched, including my hometown of Pine Bluff during that time period. Listen as Uncle Ray shares his experience in terms of where he was when this tragic day occurred.
So I got two more questions for you. Call where you were when Martin Luther King was assassinated.
I was in Washington, D.C., visiting my big brother, Dr. J.R. Owen. As a matter of fact, it was me and his wife, but we had driven from Connecticut to D.C., and we always drive. He was like an alcoholic. He just drove, but we couldn't get back. We couldn't get out because when Martin Luther King died, the city started rioting. And I was on the northeast side, and where my brother was, and I couldn't get out because the army had come in and taken over because they were looting and, you know, destroying property and so forth. And so we tried to get out, and so me and my buddy, I finally got up with him, and we drove out in the dark of night to avoid the army. Yeah, I remember that real good.
One of the hallmarks about having living history, meaning people who are still alive who can share with you the experiences, is they also have the wisdom and the experience to share with you the lessons that they learn from a time period that probably a large majority of the population cannot even relate to. Take a listen as Uncle Ray shares with us and with me some lessons that he would want future generations to take from the experiences that he underwent.
I can share this with you. It may not answer the question, but it's how sensing it. Okay. If I could convey to this generation the positives of my generation, would be the absolute beauty of our culture during those 60s and 50s. I would convey that culture, that oneness that we had, that not just sense of oneness with each other but with God. It made no difference whether or not, especially if you're a kid. Now, if you're a child or a young man, okay, everybody was your teacher in your neighborhood. The drunks, you couldn't despise a drunk because a drunk would respect you. He would respect your, he would respect your mama. He'd respect God. And very rarely you find the women drunk, but you find those men, they would respect you. They knew you. Everybody knew everybody, you know what I mean? But that culture was a culture of, how do we say it now that we got a little bit of Africanism back in? It takes a village to raise a child. That's what happened. Village raised you up. Okay, we understood quite clearly that the enemy was the white man. It wasn't the white man, it was us. It was the barrier was the white man and his culture. But we always had that culture that promoted excellence in school, excellence in education, excellence in conduct, excellence in speech, excellence in dress, excellence in your people. It was always that culture. Everybody did it. Everybody knew that the only way out was to educate your behind out, including you are the product of that.
There's an old phrase that's often used, it takes a village to raise a child. And during the 50s and the 60s, that phrase had an even greater significance, especially in light of the various dangers that children of color faced, and definitely in the Deep South and then the Jim Crow South during this time period. A lot of that philosophy carried through towards the integrated society in terms of future generations. And this was one that was imparted, and I can say was passed on to me. So listen in as I share my perspective as well as my uncle's response to this realization that I was a product of the village to raise a child philosophy of my community.
When I interviewed my mom, I told her, I don't think I should have talked about it in the interview. I talked to her about this offline, about how I said when I grew up in Pine Bluff, hated going to school. Even though I liked the schoolwork, but I hated the fact that every grade, somebody knew somebody from my family. I mean, I couldn't get away from that. It was like every grade. And because my last name was Reeves, it would throw people off, but they would just look at my face and say, yeah, I know your people are around here. And so by process of elimination, they would be like, you Ray's nephew, you Jay Jr.'s nephew, you know, who's your people? And then finally they would figure out Glenda, and they're like, okay. And my mom was nice enough to tell me that I was, in her words, she said, your generation and your friends who all, because all my friends were in the same category, because all of our parents grew up in Pine Bluff, so we all had the same problem. And she said our generation was probably the last generation to truly benefit from that village mentality in terms of, you know, you – there was no escaping somebody who knew your people, who was going to make sure that they it was a nice, friendly reminder. And I mean, Uncle Ray, at the beginning of every school year, at some point, a teacher would say, who's your grandparents? Who's your mom? Who's your dad? You look like such, you know, somebody would look at me and say, you look like Ronnie Owens. You related to him? I'm like, oh, that's my uncle. Okay. All right, so they would set the tone for the year to let us know, yes, I know your family. They never have to say, I know your family, so act right. It would be as soon as they told you who it was they knew, you knew they had an outlet to somebody. So if you clowned, guess who? You weren't going to get away too far from it.
As a matter of fact, I read a book maybe about 22 years ago, and the book was called Children of the Dream, and that's exactly what you are. Okay, you're a child of the dream, and the dream, of course, is Martin Luther King's dream, but Martin Luther King's dream came from, well, just from him being African Americans. So yeah, that's a good thing that you were raised by a village.
Taking a moment to talk about the impact of family is a serious issue with regards to Uncle Ray, because if you listen carefully to his points, he's letting you know how much the young people played an integral part in the survival and the progression of civil rights during these time periods, and how much family played a role in supporting each other in their endeavors.
Well, don't forget now, behind him going there is his friends going And of course, he, you know, our parents want to make sure that we are safe, and so they wouldn't allow us to go, you know. But we being boys, you know, I mean, boys will be boys, and we don't want to be left out. So that's how I'm sure that Sal J had felt. He didn't want to be left out of this opportunity to be a part of something big, you know. Me, I just wanted to see what was going on, because I knew they, my brother would say to me, no, you can't go. Of course, me and Louis Jr., we went everywhere, and we just went on and watch behind the line, because we couldn't take the spitting and stuff like that, you know. But yeah, that is but that was another side. The other side, don't forget, the other side was taking care of your family. You know, there was a layer of power, a border that you had to respect, or you had to tear down or overcome. And that is the border of authority. Very rarely would you have anybody African-American that was in charge, but you had white folks in charge, and, you know, the level of income, the level of money, the level of authority, you know, that's still army-like, you know, and during those times. And so you could lose your job, you could lose your welfare, you're taking care of your family, and so a lot of people shut up and be quiet. That's why children led the way, right?
Makes sense.
Yeah, that's why children led the way. They had no nothing to lose except for, and nobody was going to hurt a child or kill a child until, of course, they threw the bomb in the church. That's where you want to hurt us. You can hurt us in the church. You want to kill all black folk, wait, church style. You can. Used to be, anyway.
I want to thank everyone for taking the opportunity to tune in to my Living with Jim Crow series and the final part of my series with my Uncle Ray, Ray's Way, as he shared his experiences growing up in the rural Jim Crow South during the 1950s and the 1960s. My name is Reeves, everyone, and as always, thank you for tuning in. I hope you enjoy, and I want you to look forward to future podcasts here on In the Know with Tony Reeves.